Now I wouldn't fool you. I used to rassle up my coffee down yonder in the Piggly Wiggly, but some of that damn coffee they got there is as old as the Union, and I won't be drinking no stale coffee, even if the sweet Lord Jesus come down and ask me himself. No, I be drinking Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. That's right, you'll get your coffee in the same time it took the Lord to make the world. And you can order coffee as you need it, or take advantage of Sparkplug's autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That offer applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? Life is short. Drink better coffee. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Oh, Miss Baby, you are the living end.
Oh, Lord.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi to one and all, and thanks so very much for downloading the next 138 Project, the Monday morning venture to review every movie ever made. We're never, ever, ever going to do that, are we? Well, we're going to try.
Think positive.
We started all this by looking back at the 123 pictures on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. Some people only do one of those lists. We did both. So go scroll through all that content if you haven't already. Those have spoilers, and this episode today will also have spoilers. I'm the GD Fool backseat driver, Ryan Ellis, and here's my kindly old driver who don't pay me no never mind, my wife Bev.
That's me.
You've never been prejudiced in your life, and I know it. Let the mocking of this movie begin.
Uh-huh.
So the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Driving Miss Daisy. There have been four instances where the director of a movie that won Best Picture didn't get nominated as Best Director. Didn't even get nominated. One of them is this movie, Bruce Beresford, Driving Miss Daisy. What are the other three?
So the very first Oscars, Wings, won Best Picture, was not nominated for Best Director. Mm-hmm. Although there was only a handful of Best Director nominees, so maybe that's part of it.
Yeah.
And then not too long after that, Grand Hotel, in the 30s?
1932, the only 32. Oscar nomination it got was the one it won, Best Picture.
That is bizarre. And then it didn't happen again until Driving Miss Daisy, and then the next time it happened was Argo, where Ben Affleck famously did not get his Best Director nomination.
At least he won for producing that night. He, George Clooney, and what's that guy's name? Who's Clooney's production partner? Grant Heslov. They won for producing that night. So Affleck did win an award. In fact, Affleck is obviously best known as an actor, yet he has an Oscar for writing Good Will Hunting and producing Argo. All right, Driving Miss Daisy was somehow nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Okay, I know how. A lot of people liked it, as we'll discuss soon, but also because every American-made Best Picture winner was nominated for those lists. We've talked about that before. Hamlet wasn't. And I think Tom Jones was the other one, because they are British productions. But every other one, even if it sucked, was at least nominated for the first list, for sure. DMD was released by Warner Brothers nearly 30 years ago in mid-December 1989 to qualify for the Oscars only a few months later, then came out for everyone in late January 1990, but this is a 30-year-old movie. The film didn't have an enormous budget, but it drew an enormous amount of buttocks into seats. I don't know why. Bev, explain what the story's about with the Driving Miss Daisy. Come here.
Jessica Tandy is Daisy, an elderly, wealthy Jewish woman, and Morgan Freeman is Hoak, Daisy's supernaturally patient whipping boy, who spends 25-30 years being verbally berated by Daisy, a mean, self-absorbed woman who would honestly have to commit a war crime to be any less likable in this film. The two become unlikely friends over the years due to some combination of Stockholm Syndrome and a healthy dose of Hollywood wishful thinking.
I miss Daisy. It was 25 years, incidentally, not 30. I looked up.
I think it was 30 years when you add the retirement factor.
Okay. It's supposed to be set from 48 to 73. By the way, Morgan Freeman, of course, as you just said, is the male lead in this film. One of his other big productions, Shawshank Redemption, started 1947, is it? It's 46, one of those, the mid-40s when that one gets going, and this is around the same time frame. All right, so in a nutshell, with Driving Miss Daisy, Perpetual Asshole realizes after misunderstanding over canned fish that she should start treating her chauffeur like a real boy. And that real boy is definitely meant partly as a racial slant, because that's what this movie is always avoiding and never uses the N-word, even though these characters, you know, would have been saying it. They may have been Jewish and they may have felt oppressed in that part of the world too, the American South, but they would have been saying the N-word a lot, and they wouldn't have thought twice about it.
Do the racist cops use it?
No.
They say Negro?
I don't remember if they say even that much, but, you know, that's why they're profiling these two at the side of the road, just having lunch. You have a nice day, ma'am. But it doesn't say anything to him, because he doesn't count. All right, so this is a very racist character. We've already established that. We'll talk about it more as we go along. She does evolve a little, but is the movie itself racist? And before you answer that question, let's not forget, from what I've read before and even seeing in interviews with this guy, Morgan Freeman himself seems to love this movie. He loved it then, and I think he's loved it ever since. And I don't know why this very smart man and great actor doesn't realize his own movie is racist. I'm going to say it's racist. What do you think?
Do I think it's racist? It's racist in the sense that it is well-intentioned with absolutely no introspection. Everybody who created this film did not want to do one shred of hard work of looking into themselves and trying to get a realistic picture of what life would have been like for Hoke, or just in Georgia in general. Instead, it's like this 2-hour-long pat on the back for everybody that was ever anything less than cruel to the help.
I'll give it a little bit of credit for one thing that I have to contradict you about just now. You said 2 hours. It's actually about an hour and 35-ish minutes before the credits.
It feels much longer.
Which is nice. It's actually a relatively short movie. I was just reading today, the shortest movie nominated of the 8 for Best Picture from last year is The Favorite, which is about a minute shy of 2 full hours. That's the shortest one.
And it's a comedy.
All right. So Driving Miss Daisy, for all of its faults, at least doesn't go on for way too long, even though it does, as you said, feels a little too long. Okay, so the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 82% of critics like this movie. 49 fresh, 11 rotten, and 81% of audiences. It was 8th at the 1989 U.S. box office. The adjusted for inflation numbers, $230 million. It's one of Morgan Freeman's biggest hits. He's got a lot of big hits because he was in the Dark Knight trilogy, and he was in things like Unforgiven and 7, Million Dollar Baby. All those made $100 million or more adjusted for inflation. A lot of those made way more than that unadjusted for inflation. Bruce Almighty was a huge hit he was in, where he plays God. But this one's one of his biggest hits. Batman, I just mentioned Batman, well, the original with Jack Nicholson and Michael Keaton was number one that year. And one of your favorites, which we reviewed a couple years ago, When Harry Met Sally, was 11th, which we definitely liked more than this. What'd you think? We know it is not good. About Driving Miss Daisy.
And I've really shown my hand here. This film makes me embarrassed for every person involved in making it.
Agreed.
And every member of the Academy who was so moved by this transparent, white, guilt, wish fulfillment that they gave it Best Picture. Shame.
We always save this towards the end unless we just talk about little parts of it. Let's get through all the award stuff right now because we're talking about the Oscars. And this is Oscar month, and next week's the actual Oscars preview show for this year. So it won 4. We know it won Best Picture. Also won Best Actress for Tandy, the screenplay, and the makeup. Makeup, huh? Batman wasn't nominated for makeup that year, by the way. Maybe should have for Joker makeup. Anyway, it won for makeup.
It's pretty decent aging makeup. I've seen a lot worse than that.
All right, fair, but an Oscar? Okay, anyway. It was nominated for 5 others. Best Actor for Freeman, Supporting Actor for Dan Aykroyd.
Come on. How low is your bar?
The editing, the sets, and the costumes. These are other movies that came out that year. I mentioned Batman and When Harry Met Sally already. The other 4 nominees for Best Picture, Born on the 4th of July, which won Best Director for Oliver Stone, Field of Dreams, one of my very favorite movies, period, My Left Foot, good movie, definitely, and Dead Poets Society, for all of its faults, was very popular that year and still is popular with a lot of people now.
I do suspect that if Dead Poets Society had won the Oscar that year, we would be sitting here right now making fun of Dead Poets Society. But I do like Dead Poets Society a lot better
than I've seen that lots of times. It's on our shelf over there. I love the ending for all that movie's faults. That is a really uplifting ending. Another Oliver Stone war movie, because he had won for Platoon 3 years before, wasn't likely to win again. He won for Best Director that night, so he had 2 Oscars already. Well, 3, actually, because he won for writing long before, and his movie won for Platoon. He didn't produce it, so he didn't win the Oscar for producing. And they probably wanted Uplift. And the biggest thing of all is that this was a movie about racial awakening made for infants, I guess, or for very old people, yes. And that's the key thing. So why did it win the Oscar? Because rich old people are applauded for budging even a few inches to accept anyone different from them. Just a little bit. The inching towards decency in Driving Miss Daisy is perhaps more real than if Daisy had just accepted Hulk with open arms from the beginning, or even at midway through. She never really truly accepts him, even when she says that AFI nominated, quote, Hulk, you're my best friend.
Well, she has to be full-blown senile before she utters that. No, it's not full-blown yet. That is full-blown senile.
She's not in the home yet, though. That line is said when she's still in her house.
Yeah, because they haven't put her in the home yet. But she's running around saying she's got to go to school and teach the children.
Oh, that's right.
She's absolutely out to lunch.
She does say
that. One of the many dumb things in the movie is the idea that yesterday, Hulk went to work and everything was fine. And today, he went there and she's running around in her nightgown like a batty, crazy woman talking about her students. People don't become senile that quickly. It doesn't happen like that.
Well, that's true. It also reminds me of a scene in, what was that documentary, where George Wallace, meaning the guy from the 60s, the one in Alabama, the governor, he didn't want black students going into whatever that college was. Forrest Gump has a scene with this, actually, one of the many things they put Forrest into. But anyway, that guy is interviewed many years later in some documentary where his black manservant, whatever he's supposed to be, is standing beside him and he says, "This man's my best friend."
I want an interview with that man.
And George Wallace is acting like, well, look what I learned. And I don't know if he is trying to reference Driving Miss Daisy. Probably not. But it just reminded me of that. And Wallace was certainly worse than Daisy in this movie, but same kind of thing, at least. All right, other movies that came out that year, I want to mention them right now because these are all such great titles. And some of them have some similar themes, movies that are trying to be about something important. Do the Right Thing.
Do the Right Thing.
Not nominated. None of these are now for Best Picture. Not nominated for Best Picture. Glory. Denzel Washington's 3 seconds towards the end of that movie, where Matthew Broderick's been, spoiler alert, shot dead. And all of them look at him, including Morgan Freeman, is in that movie too. What do we do now? This look on their faces. Denzel, who earlier said, I'm not going to carry your flag, sir. He gets up, grabs the flag. Come on! That 3 seconds of unity between the now dead white colonel and this black former slave, the way that they're bonding without even necessarily bonding the usual way, that means way more to me than this whole movie does. Anyway, Crimes and Misdemeanors by Woody Allen, one of his best movies. Drugstore Cowboy, good film. Parenthood. And yet this was their pinnacle that year. The last plot I'll mention, that we always get to at the end usually at least, is it was 77th on the top 100 Cheers. It's Wonderful Life was number one. Does this movie cheer you at all? Does it inspire you?
It makes my eyes roll so far back.
It makes my eyes roll and rain.
No raining, just rolling. Just an exasperated sigh that can be heard from space.
The movie has authentic touches, despite our misgivings about a lot of it. But one thing that bothered me greatly, and I guess it's supposed to, but when grown black men have to say, sir, yes'm, he's basically a modern slave. And it's also so weird seeing and hearing Morgan Freeman, who wasn't a star yet, but still, Morgan Freeman be so deferential. Again, it's authentic. He's got to play a role. But we never seen a real layers to him. I just finished reading before we sat down Roger Ebert's review. He raved. 4-star review. Love their performances. They do the best they probably can with this screenplay. But we don't learn anything about Morgan Freeman's character. Midway through, it's mentioned he has a daughter and he's wearing a wedding ring. Oh, right, he's got a family too. We never see any real evidence of them until his granddaughter at the very end.
And who doesn't have a line. Okay. She drives him to the retirement home, I guess. Instead of having any kind of exchange with her, they just do this nod thing because the production is like, we can't afford to give her a speaking part. Let's save money. Does the granddaughter really need to have a personality of any kind? Absolutely not.
We can't make the movie an hour and 41 minutes long. It's got to be an hour and 39-ish.
Well, it's probably more that it costs more to have an actor have a speaking part. Whenever you see a scene like that, you know it's the production trying to save money.
No, I think it's because she doesn't matter.
Well, that's just it. Daisy's children have their own separate plot lines. They're a big part of the film. His life begins and ends in Daisy's house. We never see what goes on in his life outside of this. The writer,
Alfred Ury. U-H-R-Y.
So he grew up in Georgia, and he said that he wrote it about his grandmother's relationship with her own driver. I believe it's authentic to that experience, but you have a person who grew up as a boy, probably having all kinds of black servants in his life, and he sees them being deferential. He sees them always with the yes'm and the endless patience of Job, constantly, and he took all that at face value and wrote a movie about it, assuming that they behaved exactly the same outside of their place of work. Oh, sorry, they have a place outside their place of work? Actually, no, they don't. They don't go anywhere. What is it with video game avatars, where they do that dance on the spot when they're waiting for somebody to interact with them? That's what Hulk is doing while he's waiting for Daisy to berate him.
People that like this movie might argue that's the point, but I don't think they are saying that. And if they were, it's way too subtle. This is not a very subtle movie, and if that is a touch they're going for, that is very fine, and I don't think that they're doing it.
This movie gives no credit to its audience. You can't assume that it's being subtle about anything. They pass a sign that says, Phoenix, 30 miles. And then the next thing that happens is Daisy saying, well, that sign just said Phoenix is 30 miles away! As if we're just as illiterate as Hulk. Every time somebody picks up a phone, and they're like...
Yeah, we talked about that during the movie.
God, so bad. Why, no! I didn't realize that your cab company needed 3 hours' notice to give somebody a ride, and I need to get to the beauty parlor in 30 minutes! Thanks, Daisy. I'm sure that the person on the other side of the phone really needed to hear that. It's spoon-feeding us every bit of information, so we can't give it credit and assume that all of the nuance is just supposed to be subtle. In some movies, I would give that credit, but not in Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah, we talked about that during the film, the whole picking up a phone. Older movies were so guilty of this. Maybe every movie has been, but certainly the ones in the 30s and the 40s. Some of the ones we've covered have done this, where it's, bring, you pick it up. Yes, I will go over to your place right now, Bob. It's been 1 second. Bob couldn't have even said it was Bob yet, let alone that he wants you to come over to his place.
Maybe it's another case of them not wanting to pay the SAG fee for an actor to speak on the other line and say, well, no, Mr. Daisy, I can't get you a cab right now.
They're just being expeditious, I guess. But
oh, God, it's embarrassing.
We've been mocking the accents, by the way. We thought, a lot of us did, thought the accents and impressions in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou were over the top. And incidentally, one of the cops you just mentioned is Vernon Waldrop in Oh Brother. That's my fiancé.
He's bona fide.
He is bona fide. But these accents are
He's
so far...
He's a racist in that movie, too.
Yeah.
He has a type. He just looks like a punchable KKK face.
The guy he's working
for... His face
for,
that looks like it belongs in a hood.
The guy he's working for in Oh Brother is in the KKK, exactly. But yeah, these accents were mockable. I think we did a better job of mocking the movie while it was playing and just after it was done during the credits and whatnot than we ever will now. We can't recreate it. We should have recorded that, and that would be the podcast.
It's the only way I could get through it.
So Daisy talks about how she grew up poor. This reminds me of when we hear politicians do this. Marco Rubio and so many others. You're not now, asshole! My grandmother was this thing, and my grandfather was that thing. They came from this other country. Which is also one of the things that's so irritating about politicians who want to lock out other immigrants when they themselves are related to people who are immigrants. But that's such a crock of shit. I know all about being poor. You haven't been poor for a long time. Even if it was part of your life, you are now retirement age. More than half your life, you haven't been poor. It's like me saying, I know all about the country I grew up out there. I haven't lived there since I was a fucking 19 years old kid.
Her refusal to own up to her wealth and privilege in the face of a man in his 70s who still needs this job bad enough that he has to eat her foul shit every day. It is so oblivious of all the things that make her detestable, and the movie just keeps going over and over with this. They always repeat these scenes where she's like, oh, I'm a not rich. Bitch, you have a man who's retirement age driving you around to your Piggly Wiggly and your Mahjong games and your whatever. I get the impression she hasn't worked in a long time. I know she was a teacher once upon a time and she raised a whole child and everything.
Her husband was rich, though.
But her husband was rich.
And now her son is rich.
Yes.
He got the business, didn't he? Isn't that what it's supposed to be?
Oh, well, I guess so.
Family business.
In fairness, it seems like he's a hardworking man who takes his business very seriously. So seriously, in fact, that he will not attend an MLK dinner because he's afraid his racist customers won't look kindly upon that. Mm. Does anybody give him a hard time about that? No. Are we, as an audience, expected to like him any less because he sides with his racist customers and clients over the civil rights movement? No. Don't think that hard about it. Don't challenge yourself about it. You're still a good person because one time you let your chauffeur go to the bathroom.
Daisy is seeing the world is changing but doesn't invite Hoke in to be a part of the MLK speech when he is a black man and you have another ticket.
There's maybe two times that Hoke stands up for himself, really. And one is when he has to take a leak so bad.
Gotta make water.
And she...
has an irrational fear of crickets and an owl.
Oh my God.
Hulk, you've been gone for 4 seconds.
Honest to God, he's taking a leak. Will you relax, you crazy woman? She seriously is like, no, you cannot go to the washroom. You can just wait until we get there. And he's like, I'm a man and I have to make water. And the other time is when she invites him at the very last minute to accompany her to this MLK speech.
Does she actually invite him in?
Yeah, she says, I have an extra seat. Isn't it the funniest thing, Boo? We thought you would want to come with me. And he's like, I'm not going to be your pity invite at the very last minute. I don't even understand her motives in that scene.
Well, because they're best friends.
Oh, my gosh.
You're my best friend.
And then he sadly is listening to that in the car.
Making me live. Ooh, I've been wandering around. Anyway, sorry. Queen's really on my mind. Bohemian Rhapsody, we saw it not that long ago. Not the best movie, but I re-love Queen. I was dead. I love them all over again. Sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
We can't say that Bohemian Rhapsody was the best movie, but Queen is one of the best bands ever. Oh, yeah. So we were reminded of that. That was nice. So, yeah, he sits in the car and he would rather listen to it rather than get this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see MLK in the flesh. That's about the only time he stands up to her.
That and the making water. Well, something that's actually a key moment in the whole film. I mentioned the salmon thing, the canned fish. She's ready to fire the guy because he took a can of salmon rather than eating the leftovers that she left for him. And then, of course, another movie thing where you expedite things. And we've seen this kind of thing done in movies. It's not a terrible scene, I guess. But he brings the can of salmon. And then the next thing we see is her teaching him to read in the cemetery. It's supposed to have been sometime later, I guess. But the notion is she'll start actually treating him like a person because he did one right thing. But even if she was right, what kind of jerk-off dwells on a tin of salmon?
A rich woman and a 33-cent can of salmon.
And she's already been dealing with him for a while at this point. He's been her driver. They've had some disputes, but it hasn't been that big a deal. Good God. The cemetery scene I rewatched, there's something about this I do kind of like, actually. Not so much that he reveals he's illiterate, and then she does the whole sort of, I've taught all kinds of dumb kids, and I can teach. She implies that he's dumb, but I don't think she means to be that way. What I took from it, though, was a very interesting thing we've seen on Facebook. People post this kind of stuff all the time. One of these stupid memes you see by people, your grandmother, your mother, your aunt, whatever, will do this kind of thing. Because she's telling them Bauer, B-A-U-E-R, is where she wants him to put flowers. So she spells out the B and the R, and then he does find it. What you see on Facebook a lot of times is the A-U-E won't be in the right order.
Oh, the trick where, once you're highly literate, you look at a sentence and
your brain puts the letters in the right place. Yeah. They deliberately, in those kinds of things on Facebook, will have the letters in the middle, whether it be two or three or even more, out of place.
Jumble them, yeah.
And I could follow it very easily. I've done that more than once. And it's not even a matter of, okay, I got that one. Okay, now this word. Now this word. It's seamless,
you
I find.
You just get a flow. Yeah, it's quite
interesting.
So it's quite
it wasn't possible. What they were going for in that, I don't think, but she's teaching him to read. And so anyway, I took that from that one scene, at least.
If throughout the movie there was any benefit exhibited to his literacy, and of course you don't need to exhibit a benefit to literacy. Literacy is always going to improve someone's life, even in the most minor ways, but absolutely would be, for anybody in the 40s, 50s, 60s, easier to get through life literate. But they never show it benefiting his life in any way. It's not like by reading the paper he suddenly then learns about the world and gets some insights that are important to him, or learn other tasks in his job that get him forward in some way or another, because he never advances in his job. He just starts cooking too after Idella dies. God forbid she hires someone to replace her.
And he must be cleaning up the house, because she might be doing some of it, but she can't do all of it. He has to be contributing to that too.
Even though he's at that point like 75 years old.
Or at least in his late 60s, I guess, by then.
Well, he's 60 when she hires him.
Really? Yeah.
I did the math. There was somewhere it said like how old he was at the end of the film. He's about 10 years younger than her, which means he was 85 when he retired.
Oh,
so she can complain all she wanted about how she's not rich. But here's a man who has to work until the age of 85. And not just work, but work for the most insufferable, ignorant boss.
That's probably true. Both of those things, especially for a black person in the South. You work till you die. That's becoming more true again now, it seems. Most people have to face that fact. Our age is certainly younger. They're probably going to have to work until they die. Not in a job like this. Not that he's working that hard. He's not an actual slave. He's not in the fields breaking his back every day.
Just breaking his spirit by putting
I'm not saying it's cool.
Yeah.
But the fact that he has to work until he dies is something that is coming back around again now. Hey, he had it way worse than we ever will. Any people in our generation. But just saying, the middle class, and one of the things that Roosevelt did around the time the movie starts, Roosevelt died only a few years before this. He put in place things like Social Security, so you didn't have to work until you died. But a black man in the South, even into the 70s, probably would have had to. Everybody in this movie seems to get really old really fast. We see the senility, we see them selling the house, and then the very end of the film when Daisy knows who everyone is, but probably is starting to go to that point where she isn't fully sure who people are. I saw this with my grandmother. She recognized me. She certainly knew my mom, obviously, and my sister. But other people in our family who she didn't know as well, I could see the wheels turning. It's like, who is that? That's my other grandson. That's my daughter-in-law. I can't go. Oh, yes, I think so. And then anyone else, it's more a matter of, yeah, you're great, you. So I've seen that kind of thing, too. I'm not saying I want the movie to be longer, but they really do speed ahead as it gets along. As she becomes senile, and then she's just in that home in about 10 minutes. He serves the bitch to the end, spoon-feeding pie into her mouth, and the hokum and bullshit right directly into ours.
And she's the meanest to the end. She's just not mean to Hoke in the end. She's mean to Booley. Booley, who, for whatever faults, is the most loyal, devoted son. And she may hate the woman that he married, but, you know, when you grow up with a mother like that, maybe you are going to marry a bitchy wife, too. She's not even as bad as Daisy.
No, definitely not.
Patti LuPone is Florine. She's right to hate his mother.
Yeah, Patti LuPone is a Broadway primarily actress. She's done a lot of TV stuff. But they wrote the role for this movie because they wanted to court her to get in. I'm not really sure on that. They are casting maybe the biggest star going into it, because as long as she'd been in the business, Jessica Tandy wasn't a star.
Well, Dan Aykroyd was a producer.
That's what I'm getting to. Morgan Freeman wasn't a star yet, but Dan Aykroyd was, from the SNL days, Blues Brothers, Ghostbusters, obviously, and the sequel, which also came out in 1989.
And even though I was 11 years old when this film came out, I still remember critics everywhere tripping over themselves to praise his performance in this film. At the time I saw it, and I was like, I guess I'm missing something, because this just looks like a pretty run-of-the-mill performance with his hokey accent and, oh, mama. There's nothing particularly special or nuanced about it, and watching it again now, it's not like I have a problem with his performance, but praise is so unwarranted. I actually can get behind the Jessica Tandy nomination because I do think that for all of her faults as a character and how much I think she deserves all the vile I'm giving her, her performance does include enough nuance and depth that you do at least believe the cruelty that comes from her is coming from a place of vulnerability. Morgan Freeman, I love him too, but this is...
He's almost step and fetch it, I think, in this.
Yeah,
and again, maybe it's written that way. Well, it's obviously written that way. Maybe his interpretation was, I'm going to be playing a part. I've talked about this 100 times in this podcast. I love when actors in the movie have to play a character. So they are a character, but they're also playing for the other people on the screen or whatever. And it's probably for the best he doesn't turn to the camera, have a little moment where he's, yes, Miss Daisy, you got it. You're the funniest. You're the living end. And then turn to the camera that only we can see and have a look that goes, oh, this fucking asshole over here, huh? But because they never have a moment like that at the same point, you wonder, is this guy completely sold? Is he just an Uncle Tom? Which isn't the end of the world if he is. It isn't actual slave times. That's great if he's actually happy in this job or if he really does like her. But we never really get to know if he does or not, because the movie doesn't really care about him except when he's with her.
He's kind of like a Song of the South. I might be using this phrase wrong, but it just kind of seems a little bit like shucking and jiving, right?
Yeah,
like
he's the magical, happy slave,
the magical Negro.
In Gone with the Wind specifically.
Mm-hmm. When I think of his performance, I think of that Hattie McDaniel quote, that amazing Hattie McDaniel quote where people were like, how can you be in these movies that are racist? And you have complained about how Morgan Freeman loved this film. Hattie McDaniel said, well, I'd rather make $700 a week playing a maid than $7 a week being a maid.
Yeah.
Even in 1989, that was obviously still true because this film was so successful, got so much praise, got the Academy Award, that it was still true that this is what Hollywood wants to see from their black actors.
What was Hattie McDaniel going to do in the late 30s, early 40s, overweight black woman? Play maids. Esther Rolle is the maid for Daisy. She's best known from Maude and the spinoff Good Times, where she played Florida. And you call it, although you've seen the movie before.
I didn't
remember this.
It.
Oh, you remember this. I don't remember the scene where she's picking peas and what is it, something about how...
Don't you spill those peas.
Right, I never have in my life. And we'll probably get that accent wrong. And of course, that's where she drops the peas on the floor and that's where she dies. She's the wise and wise-ass old maid who suffers the rich and oblivious boss the whole film.
She doesn't have much of a personality aside from, oh, that's a Miss Daisy.
Like, Idella. She's probably got the fourth most screen time, though, in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just a two-hander. Dan Aykroyd's not in it all that much. He's in it third most for sure. Well, Freeman's been in the business for 50-plus years now. We're talking the mid-60s when he got going, and he's still working. Despite some of the recent issues he's had in the Me Too movement, he hasn't been as bad as some of the other people, and maybe that's why he's still getting work. I looked him up. He's got some things in the hopper. Dustin Hoffman does not. Bryan Singer? Now, he did just make a movie, but does not.
Yes, he does. It's been in the headlines. There's
headlines. What, Brian Singer? This. Oh, yeah. Well, IMDb doesn't.
He has a project.
IMDb does not have it then.
Okay, well, Jezebel sure is talking about it.
Okay.
And Twitter, too.
But a lot of actors, is my point, who've had some of these issues lately. Maybe Dustin Hoffman's just going to shrink off into the sunset and say, I'm done then. Never mind. What's the point of this? He is past retirement age, as is Morgan Freeman. So if they left the business, they certainly could. They're not 40 anymore.
You're inviting criticism by continuing to work when you could retire and working in an environment where people are going to start calling you out on your past behavior. If you just quietly disappear, then maybe you can save your legacy. Yeah, he's at an age where he should retire. I was thinking about this recently because I was looking at some old Oscar footage for work. Casey Affleck, we haven't seen much of him since he won the Oscar and everybody was criticizing that for his Me Too moment.
He's finally addressed it recently, a month or two ago, maybe four months ago.
Oh, I missed that.
I think he finally acknowledged that he did something wrong, but was very couched in how he said it. The poster child for this, so far at least, has been Dan Harmon.
Yeah, he just said the best apology.
The woman who accuses me of treating her badly, of harassing her, whatever it was he specifically did, she's not wrong. I did those things, and I'm sorry about it. And he elaborated, but that was his message rather than, well, I was drunk at a party, and by the way, I'm gay, like Spacey did.
Everything she said was right, and I am so sorry, and now that I see how it affected her, I was wrong, and she's not making anything up, she's not exaggerating. Mm. It was very much validated, everything she said, and she thoroughly accepted his apology, even though he put her through a lot.
Morgan Freeman's thing is more what George Bush Sr. was doing to people, by the sounds of it.
He's a grab ass.
Which isn't cool. It's not as bad as some other people. But maybe that's why he survived and it really didn't take off, the whole controversy with him. We've covered him a lot in our podcast now, twice for the Top 100 Project, unless I'm forgetting one of the movies he might have made, but Unforgiven and Shawshank Redemption. Plus we did Seven and The Dark Knight. All those are good performances. Obviously he's got a bigger role in Shawshank than anything else. I guess Seven, actually, he's probably the lead in that, too. Smaller roles in Unforgiven and The Dark Knight. He's played God, and he basically is a god. He's beloved by so many people, even after the controversy. And that's kind of cool, actually, because here's a black actor who didn't hit stardom of any kind until he was already in his 50s. Because
yeah, that's
he was
a great
born,
story.
I think at 37, along with Nicholson and Hoffman, a lot of people were born that year. They'd already been acting for 20 years or more, all those guys at that point. And here he finally comes along and does some movies in the mid-80s and gets a nomination for Street Smart. Then a big 1989 with Lean on Me, Glory, and this has that great voice. But again, not a great performance in this movie.
He played Hoke off-Broadway.
As a lot of people have played on or off Broadway, including James Earl Jones. This is a very popular play that got put on Broadway all over again, and still now, as far as I understand it. Jessica Tandy started acting in the 30s and ended in 1994 with Nobody's Fool, a Paul Newman movie, where I think she's actually quite good. That is an underrated film. A lot of good actors in that, too. You got Bruce Willis in a fun role, Philip Seymour Hoffman before he was known by anybody, and then Newman himself in one of his more underrated great roles. She's also in Cocoon and Fried Green Tomatoes. That was her other nomination. She had two in a row there. All right, two in a row? No, 2 to 3 years, I think it was. Anyway, no, you know what it was? She and Kathy Bates are both in that movie, and they were the ones that won the Oscars in 89 and 90, and now Fried Green Tomatoes is 91. So the past two winners are in a movie together. That's what it was. Katharine Hepburn, Betty Davis, Lucille Ball, Angela Lansbury were all in talks maybe to get this role. Might have even been Bette Midler and Eddie Murphy, which would have been strange casting. It doesn't have to be an older man, I guess, but Eddie Murphy was still pretty young at this point. Midler wasn't exactly old either, I don't think.
Can you imagine Eddie Murphy as Hoke? It would just be a completely different movie. That combination would never end with him happily eating all that shit.
Probably not. Tandy's the oldest Best Actress winner, even now, after all these years. She was 80 when she won the award. The only older acting winner in any category was Christopher Plummer. He was 82 when he won for Beginners. And there have been older nominees, including Plummer, for All the Money in the World. But not older winners in the acting category.
Yeah, yeah. John Williams still getting nominated now, isn't he?
Yeah, didn't he for Force Awakens? I think so. Maybe even Last Jedi.
So Daisy is the main character in the truest sense, in the sense that she's the only character that really experiences any kind of growth in the film. It's her arc. Another disappointing way. The movie patting itself on the back that over the course of 30 years, she grows just a little itty bit.
But that's what Hollywood likes.
Yeah, exactly.
Make slight changes. You're already an established person. You're retirement age. And you're barely sort of accepting people different from you. Applause!
It's crazy that it takes the synagogue bombing for her to wake up to the civil rights movement when, A, you're Jewish and you were alive during the Holocaust. But also, you were living in the South of America just 4 years before that synagogue bombing is supposed to take place. there was a church that blew up and killed four children, four little girls in that church bombing, but, you know, those were black children, so it didn't really make Daisy's radar. But then a bomb goes off in her backyard and her synagogue, and then suddenly it changes her. It is alarmingly undemanding and forgiving of that self-centered kind of growth and progression.
A more subtle screenplay, you could say that's what they're going for, and maybe they are going for that, but it is kind of clang, clang, clang on the piano rather than playing the notes gently and a little more subtly. All right, I think I mentioned his name once already, but just like the Oscars, he wasn't, well, the people that won the awards that night mentioned his name a lot, as they probably should have, because he wasn't even there, I don't think, because he wasn't nominated. But he is Bruce Beresford. He's now 78 and still working. His best movie is not this, obviously, Tender Mercies. Robert Duvall won Best Actor for that movie. That's a much better film. I like that one quite a lot.
I think directors deserve credit, whether they win or get nominated or not, for the movies that they make. If their actors are getting nominations, then I think directors deserve a certain amount of credit for that.
He's got maybe six actors with any significant screen time in this entire movie, and half of them were at the awards with nominations. So you're right, that's something to be said for that. Okay, his writer Alfred Uhry. This was a Pulitzer Prize-winning play.
Oh, come on.
So it won an Oscar and a Pulitzer Prize.
It's fun in the way that there's all these really creative turns of phrase, but at the same time, it just feels like this embarrassing overkill, this caricature of the South on top of everything else that we're complaining about.
And it's not the movie's fault, but the same year as What's Going On and Do the Right Thing and even Glory, which has been criticized by a lot of people for what it's not doing right, but it's doing a lot of things right, and Do the Right Thing is really doing them right. The producers were Richard and Lily Finney Zanuck, his wife, who was 20 years younger than he was. He's dead now. They were married for quite a long time, though. I thought maybe it was his daughter when they went up there on stage together, and I looked it up. But no, they were married. David Brown, who's Richard Zanuck's partner for many years, including on The Sting and Jaws, as production partners, was an executive on this, but didn't get to go up on the stage. But Richard and Lily won the Oscar. That was a rarity at that point for women winning Oscars. We see it so much more now. Dee Dee Gardner is nominated again this year. We're going to talk about this next week. She's going to break Kathleen Kennedy's record before she's even 50. I don't know how old she is right now. Before she's an old woman, at least, as the most nominated producer of all time. But at this point, Lily Finney Zanuck winning. I mentioned The Sting. That was Julia Phillips. They're two of the rare women at that point who'd even been nominated as producers, let alone had won. The movie's 185-1. We watched the TCM print from Boxing Day, I believe it was. I recorded it. And it is soft as a newborn's belly.
Yeah, it's not great.
Maybe it's intentional. But I don't think it's just going for that whole sort of gauze on the lens thing. I think it actually just is a very soft, not very good print.
There's also gauze on the lens. Every light has a glow in that movie. It's that.
But it still doesn't look sharp in a non-sharp way. That makes
sense. Yeah, no, I think it was a bad print, but also that cliche period film. It's like how TV shows show you. This is taking place in the past where all the lighting is just really soft and has a bit of a glow and it has this borderline sepia tone to the color. Mm.
This movie, incidentally, won awards for Freeman and Tandy at the Globes for Best Comedy or Musical. Did we laugh?
No. We laughed at things that wouldn't have wanted us to laugh.
We laughed at each other's impressions. Ah, Miss Daisy. Oh. The cinematographer was Peter James, who also shot Alive and Meet the Parents. What a trio. The editor, Mark Warner, actually cut a lot of action and thrillers in his career. Rocky III and 48 Hours stand out in the early 80s. But then he cut this very slow-paced movie. Well, not that slow-paced, but anyway. And this is something I'd not remembered at all. The composer, Hans Zimmer, who's become a legend. You mentioned John Williams. Well, Zimmer's up there with him in modern composers.
That's funny. Do-do-do-do-do. Could you ever imagine Hans Zimmer, as you know him now, making that little do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-
Cool Runnings, Driving Miss Daisy, Rain Man, the year before this, so he was involved in two straight Best Picture winners as a composer. Thelma and Louise, The Lion King, and now all the Ridley Scott, Chris Nolan movies he's done. He also did Gladiator, I believe, so that's another Best Picture winner he composed for. But yeah, that music you're doing right there, they played that when people won Oscars, as Tandy went up on stage and the producers went on stage for Best Picture. It's kind of gotten my head a little bit of an earworm there, but anyway, what'd you think about the music cutting and the cinematography?
I hated the cinematography, because yeah. I really, really hate that terrible, glowy, cloying cinematography.
Okay, very fine.
I hate the score, but I think part of that is that that score has actually become quite synonymous with the movie, and synonymous with this kind of movie, this cutesy and unchallenging historical film. Scene by scene, the movie's editing was excellent, but as the whole, the movie has strange pacing, and it's hard to determine how much time is passing from one scene to the next.
They'll do the whole thing where they show the tree blooming, so now it's spring and into the summer.
Yeah, or they'll do something so tragically obvious, like Bully holding up a trophy that has the year 1966.
And even say, whatever the year.
Again, of course, it's 1966. Thanks, Bully. Everyone around you should know that. I don't know why you're saying that out loud. It's really strange. It's actually super awkward. But then other times it would be difficult to tell what time and place you're in. So I think the editing was mostly good. And then, of course, I always love a short movie.
Well, as short as it is, maybe it isn't all that well paced, though. All right, so some connections. We talked about it being a popular play on the stage even now, with James Earl Jones and others playing Hoke. I always remember the scene in Be Kind, Rewind, an underrated film from 2008. Most Def's character is not comfortable with sweeting, as they say, that movie because it's racist. Jack Black is playing Daisy in the backseat. Come on, Hoke! I'm not comfortable with this. I don't like this. And he's not wrong. And also, the first car is a Hudson. They drive several cars in the movie. But the first time we see it, it's kind of that Star Trek sort of, this is the Enterprise, when she finally gets in the car when she's walking along. I mentioned Rain Man. There's a scene in that movie, too. Rain Man doesn't want to be in the car after that accident about midway through the movie. So then Charlie lets him walk along and finally get in the car when they get on some little side street. So two straight movies with people who won't get in cars. But when Daisy finally does in that scene, you see the hood of the car and the tire and this big momentous moment. We're going to start driving Miss Daisy.
This movie's so bad.
But the first car that he drives her in is a Hudson, and Paul Newman's character in Cars is a Hudson. He's Doc Hudson. I don't know if that's really a connection, but I think it's worthwhile. I covered all the awards and AFI lists. 77th on Top 100 Cheers, huh? And all the Oscars.
It's my theory that this movie was catapulted to Best Picture by all the old rich Academy voters who really badly want to believe that their black and Hispanic employees love them, even though
that's
they verbally berate them on the daily. I really just believe that they all want to so badly think that their Hoke or their Idella actually loves them, even though they are terrible employers and look down on them. I really think that's why this movie could have possibly won Best Picture, but it's embarrassing. They should be ashamed of themselves if they believe the message that it's giving them. You need some introspection. Hoke, give me a break. He's not a remotely real person. He is so patient. Jesus himself would not last 1 hour with Daisy. He would drive them both off a cliff.
She's worse to her son than she is to Hoke, though.
She's a terrible human being. I will defend Jessica Tandy's performance and that I actually do think that she gave a good nuanced performance, but Daisy as a character is indefensible. Let's drive this whole movie straight to hell where it belongs. The end by Bev Ellis.
You touched on something I meant to get to earlier in the podcast. Not to throw shade on people when we don't even know them, but I've often wondered about Hollywood people, big stars, the Spielbergs and Lucases and the Streisands and the Cruises and the Hankses. Maybe they're all wonderful people with their servants. But those servants, for those people I just mentioned and a lot of other people in that town, better get paid quite well. They don't need to be rich, but those people should be talking to their friends saying, so you're a servant. Yeah, but I work for Mr. Spielberg. I'm cool. I bet they're not. And also, this notion that, yeah, I care about my servant's life. Do you?
Mm.
But this movie's saying, if you pay even basic attention to these people and give them some respect once in a while after a quarter of a century, pat on the back.
Yeah.
Very insulting stuff. But part of the reason why this movie won Best Picture, maybe the reason why, is because in the Academy, then for sure, and even now, it has way more daisies than it does Hoke.
Yeah, and I think now it's getting a lot more Hoke than daisies.
It's bouncing out.
Oh,
yeah.
Before we wrap it up, I have to pass on this quote that I found in a pretty old cracked article about movies that aren't supposed to be about race but are unintentionally racist. Driving Miss Daisy was number one. Bobby Roberts wrote this article for Cracked in 2009. My favorite line that I have to quote, "Nothing fosters understanding like decades-long servitude to a pruny rich bitch who talks so much shit her teeth are literally brown." Because Sandy really has brown teeth.
You is right, there, Miss Baby. I seen your notes, by the way, before we totally wrap up. The Help. Not a good movie either.
And oh, yeah, yeah.
Guess who was a producer on that movie? And again, I don't mean to shit on this guy because I've always liked it, but Steven Spielberg was a producer on that film. And I think it's one of those whole sort of, let's give them some recognition. Hey, they're the stars of that movie. They're in the movie more than anyone else is, the black characters.
I mean, at least we got a real snapshot of the lives of black women outside of their household sphere. But where would they be without this totally fictional woman writing a totally fictional book that never happened because black people had to raise themselves out of the Jim Crow South through protest, not through kindly, spunky young white women.
And that movie probably wouldn't have been made had it not been for Emma Stone and Jessica Chastain and other stars who are white in it. And Viola Davis is very good in that, and Octavia Spencer won an Oscar for that, and she's good in the film too. But I remember at the end, I thought, this uplifting song that's playing as Viola Davis walks down the street is not earned. I like the attempt in that movie. I like some of the attempts in Driving Miss Daisy, but both, as far as I'm concerned, are pretty big failures. And it's too bad, because you do have a lot of movies about race relations that have been terrific. Some of them under the cover of darkness that have never really gotten a lot of praise. Some that got some more so later on. Do the Right Thing, I mentioned a few times already, made the second AFI list. Driving Miss Daisy didn't. I bet it was nowhere near making the second AFI list.
And thank God it did. Do the Right Thing is such a good movie, but I think the reason that it took so long for people to recognize it is that it made people uncomfortable. And the fact is, when a black person makes a movie about race, it's going to make white people uncomfortable. And white people just don't like being uncomfortable. So they vote for Driving Miss Daisy instead of Do the Right Thing.
Which wasn't even nominated for Best Picture.
But the right film to have attention paid to it. And the right film that now, all these years later, 30 years later, is certainly considered 100 times more of a classic than Driving Miss Daisy.
What concerns me is that 82% of critics in Rotten Tomatoes think this movie is good. Maybe they barely think it's good. Because when I say 82%, it could be that a lot of those reviews are 3 out of 5 stars or 3 out of 4 stars. But that still means they liked it. Enough about that. We've got a lot more big issues next week, because when we return in 7 days, we'll have our fourth annual Oscars preview show. We'll certainly get into race relations and women in that podcast in a big way. We'll also get into what we know about the broadcast, the host and all that kind of stuff, and who we think should and likely will take home Gold Naked Guys on February 24th. So the coming attractions trivia for the Oscars preview podcast. This question actually introduces a theme we'll have next week. Who was the last woman to present the Best Picture Oscar award by herself, because a lot of them have done it with other people. Faye Dunaway 2 years in a row did it with Warren Beatty. And who was the last woman to host the show solo? Because Anne Hathaway did it not that long ago, but she was not solo.
So for the answer to that question, please check out our Oscar preview podcast next week. But what if you just can't wait until then? You need more Ryan and Bev in your life. Well, who can blame you? You can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered hundreds of movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, but perhaps in exchange, you could give us a rating and a review. That would mean a lot to us. Five stars. It really helps people find us, puts us right up there in that algorithm.
Even 4 stars.
And if you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code top100project at checkout. And that's all one word, top100project, and it's not case sensitive. Does a cup of coffee sound good?
It sure do, Miss Bevy. It sure do. But they don't have to go make water.
And cut.